Hello, Agnes.
Hi, Robin. I would like to talk about fighting.
Okay, and can we pick a prototypical example of fighting? Like some, or maybe three examples to work with. What would you consider some examples of fights?
So I think that it's maybe useful to have one example be just like two animals tugging, fighting over a carcass, right?
Okay.
So they're each trying to get the carcass for themselves.
Baboons say.
Yeah. Maybe we want to even pick a little bit of a less sophisticated animal than a baboon.
Vulture, vulture.
Vultures. Yeah, let's pick vultures. And then maybe our second example, we could have like a fist fight that erupts at a bar because somebody thought that somebody else insulted them.
Okay. Insult fist fight.
And then a third example might be, we talk about political fights. So people fighting against their political opponents and scoring certain
Fight over
victories.
the abortion rights in America.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Okay, so
Good. I'm glad we have some concrete examples.
I'm
Well,
glad
we
you're
could
glad.
say, okay, well, I mean, we can just notice some things that we just generally know about fights. Like they tend to be disapproved. Society tends to say bad things about fights. Fights are bad, and except for some things like the abortion fight, where
Exactly. So this is what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the phenomenon that a fight can go from being bad to being good. And when that happens and why it happens. And often it will only be, of course, one side of the fight that is approved of for fighting, right? But
right.
I think that a fight gets approved of insofar as it is pretend arguing. And we see the person who we approve of as quote unquote standing up for the side that is correct. So the people who are, let's say you're
So we
pro-choice.
don't approve of these vultures at all because neither of them are pretend arguments.
So I think that in the we in the case of animals, we don't approve. I'm not sure that we disapprove either. That is, we adopt neither the attitude of approving or disapproving. So one way to think about it is to think about in German, there's two different words for eating, depending on whether it's a human being or an animal doing the eating. So there's a word fressen, which is what animals eat, and then there's essen, which is when human beings eat. We sort of have that in English with, like, let's say dining or feasting or something. Animals,
Yeah.
we didn't say do that, right? But it's not that a human being can't do fressen, like that they can't. I mean, you can insult in German, you can insult a human being by describing them as fressen, as eating in the manner of an animal. And I think that we see fights that way. Fights where the person isn't standing up for some important, valuable principle is they're behaving like an animal. They're doing the animalistic kind of fighting. So the human and valued kind of fighting is the one where you are standing up for a good principle.
So, I think that we often accept humans doing the animal kind of fighting, and we quite often don't particularly disapprove of it if we see it as kind of inevitable, the sort of thing that situations produce both for animals and humans. That is, you're stuck in a situation where you might need to fight for something, and it's not obvious that that's always about a claim, but I guess that's your novel thesis you're offering for us in this conversation, that all approved fights are about claims that are true or
Yes.
false.
More specifically, they are attempts to settle a disagreement, to settle which of two parties is right.
About a claim of some
About a claim,
sort.
yes, about a claim. Right. So I think in the case you're thinking of, where we say the person is pulled into a fight and the fight is inevitable, I think you're right that we might not disapprove. I think that, human beings do all sorts of things in conditions of desperation. For instance, they might scavenge through trash for food, behaving sort of like animals, but we might not disapprove if they're starving. But I do think it's, you know, the way you can tell whether you're really in one of those animal fighting cases and it is whether or not your sense of the person's justification is doing any work. That is whether there is any glory or nobility or pride involved in the fight. The test would just be like, you know, if you like it, if it's really self-defense, say, right, that they're fighting, then if it's really self-defense, in the sense of just preserving their own life, then it should be sort of equivalent to the case where two people are on a life raft and it can't support both of them. And so one of them throws the other one overboard, unprovoked, right? That's self-defense in the sense that, so if the fighting is like that, that might be a move of desperation. We might understand it.
But we surely have fights that we are much more endorsing of. So boxing, football, you know, rap battles. We have a great many fights that we revel in, we enjoy, we celebrate.
I think those aren't real fights. That is, in the case of boxing and et cetera, people are pretending to fight. And the way you can sort of see that it's just a pretend fight is that, like, at a certain moment in the thing, it could get real. They could really genuinely get angry at each other and actually start fighting. And, you know, it actually could happen that both are happening at the same time. But the point is that, yes, we can speak of two people who are playing tennis as fighting each other and that they both want to win the tennis match. So we could use fighting that loosely if we wanted to. I was using fighting in a way where it sort of entailed some kind of animosity, which isn't entailed even in a boxing ring. You don't have to feel animosity. You could be.
So is the idea that animosity is have to be implied or it's not a fight? I'm trying to understand the relation. So
basically,
two people say competing for a promotion, you know, bosses set up employees in a competition to see who gets promoted. Now they are fighting over the promotion. Is it that animosity would be have to be required for it to be a fight or that animosity is implied? I mean, can they? I'm not understanding the relation between animosity and whether it's a fight.
So one of the things that really interests me about the concept of fight is how hospitable it is to being adopted as a metaphor in all sorts of situations for sort of the sake of motivation or whatever. So we speak of people as fighting cancer or fighting global warming or fighting poverty or fighting racism. None of those are things you can fight. But to say that you're fighting it, like to say that you're fighting cancer as opposed to just hoping to survive cancer, it has a kind of motivational force, right? You may feel motivated by the thought that you're fighting something. And so there may be some value to thinking of it as a fight. I think in the case of two people who both want a promotion, it's probably the opposite situation. So they probably do feel a bit of animosity towards one another and a bit of jealousy. And it maybe really is a bit of a fight, but they probably have some desire to not see it that way. So they're likely to deny that they're fighting. They're like, look, may the best man win, whatever. No, you know, nothing personal, et cetera. So yes, it might be a fight or it might not be a fight.
But what's the definition? So I'm just reluctant to spend too much time trying to figure out your unusual definition of the word fight. I just like to talk about fights or conflicts or animosity even. So if you have a definition, give it to us so that we can just get past it. So a fight is what?
Well, the problem is that I have a definition, but it's not uncontentious. I've already given it to you. I think fighting in the human sense, in the essence sense and not the Fresen sense, is pretend arguing.
Why do we care about what the definition of fighting is? Why can't we just talk about fighting without arguing over what the proper definition of it is?
You're the one who just asked me for a definition, so I gave you one.
But you keep saying, when I think things, you say, oh, that's not a real one or pretend one. And why can't we just talk about what they are, regardless of whether it's a pretend concept of a certain sort?
I think we can, but I think it's worth, like, let's say we had, like, we're talking about what a horse is or something, right? And we had, like, you know, and you're like, here we go, and you show me a picture of a horse. And I'm like, Robin, that's not really a horse. I mean, it's related in a significant way to a horse, but, like, there's stuff horses can do that that piece of paper can't do because it's just a picture of a horse. And so I think often it's important to notice those, the ways in which language stretches, and so you're not always in the core case.
So can we identify a claim that's interesting to discuss where we can agree on the claim, even setting aside the subtleties of different alternative definitions? Like, we might want to say, why do people fight? Well, what's the cause of fighting? Or is fighting good or bad, or something like that? Is there an interesting claim that we could posit here to discuss?
I think I've already made an interesting claim, and you made an objection, and I responded to it. So the claim that I made is fighting is pretend arguing. Most people wouldn't agree with that, so it's an interesting claim. The objection that you made is, well, there are lots of cases where people are fighting, and we might approve of it as inevitable, even if there is no, it's just the animalistic kind of fighting. And I was saying, I think that those cases are a little less prevalent than you think. That is, if someone is being attacked and they're fighting back, we see that as a very different form of self-defense than somebody pushing another person off of a lifeboat. And that's because we think that the person who's fighting back against an attacker is standing up for themselves. That is, they're upholding a principle. The attacker is wrong and they are right about the question, ought they to be attacked? So we're interpreting the encounter as being an encounter over a principle. And that's why we think it is legitimate or justified for them to, you know, intentionally hurt this person.
Let's agree then that sometimes when there are conflicts, people have shared norms about who should win the conflict on the basis of what facts about the world, and those can be more framed as disagreements. And then there are other conflicts where there are less such shared norms, where we less are able to frame it as a disagreement about a thing that we agree one side should win the conflict or another, depending on that claim. What more interesting can we say about the fact that the world has those two kinds of conflicts? Conflicts where we have a shared norm and therefore can be framed as a claim, and conflicts where we don't.
Well, the thing I was trying to say was that the very idea of winning involves a delusion. That is, everyone who believes in winning is deluded. The delusion that the idea of winning involves, because fighting is pretend arguing, is that something has happened in relation to this principle as a result of the fact that one person displayed more prowess at violence than the other. So suppose that I attack you and you successfully defend yourself against me. The idea that you were victorious or that you won is the idea that you upheld the principle, Robin doesn't deserve to be attacked. But you just upheld it by like being stronger than me. That doesn't make the principle true. So you upheld it by means of a consideration that is extraneous to the question, does Robin deserve to be attacked? And so that's my claim, is that all of fighting involves entering into a space of pretense. It's like a kind of role playing of argument.
When there's a norm that would, you know, that we agree should settle who wins the fight, and the norm is in terms of a claim, then we can agree that there's this concept of who is right about the claim that isn't the same as who prevailed in the conflict. I think we can agree on that. We agree there are these conflicts where there is no such norm at stake. There's just a conflict. So we have this concept of a conflict and who prevails, and it's separate from the concept of what was the norm at stake and who was right about the claim in the norm. I think we can agree on all those things so far.
Okay. So
what's the next thing to notice about, you know, we have norms and we talk in terms of the conflict should be settled by the norms, but often, of course, it's hard to tell who in fact the norm should have applied to, and then we have a conflict and somebody prevails. So it may be part of the things to notice here is often norms are pretty weak as constraints and situations. They're often hard to determine what the norm says about who should win. And that's why, of course, we fight and somebody prevails, because if the norm were really clear and everybody could tell, then it would be pretty obvious that we should just give in to whoever the norm said. But usually, quite often it's not clear. That's an interesting thing to notice about norms for conflicts, that the norm of who should win is often pretty ambiguous in its application in particular cases.
I think that's right. But I think there's another interesting thing, which is that like this idea of So if I'm right, then the thing we're fighting over is which of two people is correct about something. And that's a strict disjunction in that it can't be the case that they're both correct. That's the framing of it. It might be true, but like the framing is like it's either me or you. Either Robin does or doesn't deserve to be attacked in this way that I'm attacking you, right? So in that, there, like, the conceit is that there is some answer, even if we may not as a society have determined what the answer is. But the effect of that on spectators is to, like, very quickly polarize them, basically. So actually, if people see people fighting, they will tend to quickly take a side and to think, well, it's obvious that, you know, A insulted B and therefore B was right to respond with a punch, or it's obvious that A was just being a bit clueless and B was like overinterpreting and being paranoid. And so when we see fights, we're actually, because we want to see them as occasions for glory, that is, we want to enter into this theater of pretense, which says that the fight is adjudicating some question, we very, very quickly form an opinion, maybe not as a society, but as an individual, about which side we're on. So we take sides. That's what taking sides is.
So let's take one of the examples you gave, the bar fight.
Yeah.
Based on an insult, you said.
Yeah. Or perceived insult.
Perceived insult, sure. Now, in actual fact, in most situations, including that, there are a large number of norms that could be brought to bear on that situation. And
right.
In some sense, who we think should prevail may be dependent primarily on which norms we think should dominate in that context. And right. So then there's the question of, do we share norms about which norms should dominate? And there might be this conceit that we all agree on some consistent set of meta norms all the way up that would settle all disputes about which norms apply, but that seems implausible. So we might just have a conflict about which norms apply, and we might have disagreements about each norm, but we could agree on for each norm what it says, but just disagree on the meta norms about which norm applies here. That certainly seems the case in the of insults. Somebody might think of a norm that if you're insulted, it's your honor bound to defend yourself against it. Somebody else might think, you know, sticks and stones, the norm is to let all words slide off of you. Those are just two different norms people could bring to bear to that situation. And I don't know that we agree on a meta norm that says which of those norms should dominate.
I agree. My point was that if we actually see a fight before us, it's just very likely that we will land on one of the two. And in a slightly different case, we might land on the other one. But that as a matter of fact, fighting sort of has this effect. In effect, it's like we don't want to be seeing before our eyes the two animals fighting. That's very unattractive to us. We want to be seeing something else. We want to be seeing a kind of theater of argument. But in order to see the theater of argument, you have to think, oh, obviously this is one of the sticks and stones cases, or obviously this is one of the cases where you stand up for yourself. And even if at a meta level, not just as a society, but as an individual, you find both those principles somewhat plausible, it's likely that when faced with the fight, especially actually literally faced with it, like it's actually in front of you, you're going to land on one of the two.
So it sounds like we're saying that people tend to moralize their interactions, especially when there's conflict. People moralize conflicts, and so they justify their actions in a conflict in terms of some norms, such that they think there's a claim that says that they are doing the right thing in the conflict.
So
each side does that, but they may pick different norms and have different claims.
I think that I'm saying something stronger than that. That is, like, I often moralize in the sense of invoke moral principles and say that I'm morally correct, and all that is moralism. This is a kind of faux moralism in that. First and foremost, it's the participants of the fight who are going to see it this way, right? So if I'm fighting you and I see my own fighting of you in these glorified terms. So, honor is at stake. I am going to be proud of my behavior in this fight, whatever, that kind of situation, rather than the desperate animal fight. So if I see it that way, then I have to imagine that I am settling the question by attacking you. And onlookers, in order for them to see there as being glory at stake in our fight, have to do the same thing, which is to imagine that the question of which of us is right is being somehow settled by the violence that we're enacting. And so, yes, it's moralism, but it is, I guess I think not all moralism involves like kind of role-playing in an argument as in this case, imagining that you're arguing when you're not.
So let's take this concrete case of the fist fight.
Yeah.
And the bar. One person feels insulted and feels there's a principle that they should defend themselves against an insult.
Yeah.
And then they are initiating the fight on the basis of that.
Yeah.
The other person doesn't believe in that claim necessarily, and therefore they aren't invested in whether there was an insult. They just have a general, avoid fights thing, but they also have a defend yourself if attacked.
Right.
Norm. And so who's disagree? What's the claim on which they disagree? You're saying this case is a disagreement, but where do they disagree?
So all you need for a fight, or at least for some violent activity, is for one of the people to believe that there's a claim. So let's say I feel that you insulted me, and so that's why I'm attacking you. And so I think we disagree about something, namely, was your insult correct? Or were you right to insult me? But you are just like, I just want to get out of the situation, right? And so I think you might really what you do there might not be fighting. That is, you, for instance, you might just like walk away or run away. You might try to get other people to like restrain me. And even if you do resist my attacks, you would have no interest in doing so in any way that would like damage or hurt me. You're just trying to like, in the way that you kind of fight a kid who's attacking you, where you like try and, you know, so in that case, you don't see your ability to stop me as defending any principle or standing up for anything.
I would think it's the principle of defending myself against an attack. That is a principle many people will embrace.
All right. Directly. So I think that is, so you could, that's a different case than what I was imagining, right? So you could think that's an important principle and I'm standing up for that principle by punching her, right? So then we really are fighting. In your mind, we're fighting over that principle. In my mind, we're fighting over something else. So we don't have to agree about what we're fighting.
So you're saying each side sees that there's a principle at stake and that they are defending.
Imagines that there's a
principle.
Okay, but yeah.
For there to be a disagreement, I would think that two people needs to have a different opinion on the same topic. If they have opinions on different topics, that's not a disagreement, right?
That's a good point. I think that fighting is pretend arguing. And it might well be that the disagreements in fighting are pretend disagreements. That is, I'm not sort of committing to the thought that there's a real disagreement. I think often when you talk to two people who are fighting about a situation, even politically or whatever, they frame it in very different terms. And you actually really struggle to get them to line up and say, what exactly do you disagree about?
We could say they disagree about the proper framing of the conflict, perhaps.
Maybe. And I guess I want to say I don't think it's impossible that there is sort of one claim on which they have opposite views. It's not impossible. And maybe it's especially likely. So as you move from fist fights up through political fights, maybe it becomes more likely that there is one claim that people are fighting over. But in any case, that's not essential to the definition of fighting. That what's a sort of essential to it is that each party thinks that there is something like glory or self-respect or pride or something to be won through their conduct in this fight because they're upholding a principle.
So in the world where we settle disputes, in law, say, or academia, we have processes that settle disputes. And yeah, those processes are conflicts. And then we generally have norms of accepting the results of those processes to settle disputes. that you have a legal trial and you try to win the case, but then there's a ruling and then you should accept the process. So in many contexts, we see ourselves as having disagreements, but then that we are to accept the ruling that settles the disagreement through a conflict. So it seems like in a literal sense, we're not misled about the fact that we are in fact going to decide who's right based on a conflict-based process.
So I think that, I'm not sure how to think about those cases. And sometimes I think about them as we have like a bunch of societal fictions that like, in effect, we're going to agree to pretend like our disagreement was resolved. And we both have to just like live with that pretense and act out that pretense afterwards. There may be some of that, at least in some cases, is not that it gets resolved, but that this is a particularly good way to pretend that it's resolved. Framework though is that sometimes what we're doing in some way is negotiating, and we would each like more of something, and so we're in a conflict, and then we agree to like third party arbitration, and the third party is going to decide what's fair, and we'll each get some of what we wanted but not all of what we wanted, and that's a kind of conflict resolution. We're fighting over our parents' inheritance, right? And you would like all the money and I would like all the money. And I think, well, I took care of them in their old age. And you think, well, my name is actually in the will and hers isn't, or something. And so then we have like a judicial system to adjudicate that disagreement. And I guess I think that, maybe our thought is that we might have a bunch of different thoughts about that, about how that's working. But one plausible one is, no, the judicial system works by figuring out either which one of us is right or what intermediate position is the closest to correct, the closest to fair as a distribution.
So I'd like to go back to the more core example of, say, the scientific dispute. Or the legal dispute about a fact of, say, a guilt of criminality, say.
Yeah.
That is, we have a conflict-based process that produces a decision about the truth of a claim. And then we have social norms that often encourage us to accept that result as the truth. That is, if you're in a dispute in an academic field and you have one thesis and somebody else has a thesis, and then an experiment is done or several experiments to test you and versus them, and the experiment shows that it favors them over you. You know, after a certain point, you're supposed to be gracious and admit you were wrong and accept that it settled the question. It not just, had a resolution of the conflict, but that the resolution of the conflict you're supposed to treat that as the answer to the question that was at base of the conflict. So in that case, it doesn't seem like it's a fake or misleading pretense. We are actually accepting it as answering the question.
So that's what I was sort of getting to at the end with the inheritance. So I think that, but I think there is not exactly a conflict-based process in the sense that you're not just pretend arguing, you're really arguing. As long as the considerations that determine which side wins are relevant to the question that is being decided. So in a scientific process, if what determined which result got published was like who had more connections, then I think it would be right for someone to say, well, this was just a victory in the conflict, but I'm not going to accept that that result is true. So that sort of supports my theory, which is that if the considerations are relevant to the question, then you're actually answering the question.
But almost always reality is a mixture in between. Real conflict resolution processes, even in the best cases of academia or the law, are processes that have influences that are correlated with the truth, but they also have influences based on who has what connections or who's how articulate and a wide range of other influence. So the actual difficult fact about our best institutions even is that you have to accept that both are going on. So, but we still encourage people to accept the result of a good enough process as if it were the truth, even though we know there are these other influences over the process.
Yeah, that just might be that there's a little bit of lying involved. That is, in the case of a war, right, where you have two countries that are duking it out over, let's say, the one country's right to be autonomous and govern itself. It seems like the question how many of each side can kill of the other side is entirely separate from the question of does this country deserve to be autonomous, or is it a good country, or something like that. And so there, the gap is so big and glaring that it's all theater. Like, in the case of war, is pretty much all theater. Except in special cases where what the war is actually seeking to determine is just like who has a stronger army or something. Fair enough.
But in the case of, say, Ukraine, Russia at the moment, many people would say, well, what's happening is that the war is inviting nations of the world to vote on which side they support, and that the side with the most international support does deserve to win, and we are finding out who is willing to give how much support to which side. So it's not just a conflict of the soldiers or something. It's a plebiscite where the world is expressing their confidence and a strength of opinion about who should win. And many conflicts are like that. That is, we are often supposed to accept, if one side gets more strength, it's because there's this larger support for that side. Even say a jury trial, right? More votes in the jury is supposed to decide the ruling, but it's based on this idea that the side with more support on average is right.
Right. So I think that, like, there's a question, is the side with more support right on average? And I think there might be some reason to think that that's true in the case of a jury, and maybe less reason to think that that's true in the case of, let's say, certain forms of politics, right? And such that we're in an election or whatever, we're not necessarily the candidate who gets the most votes. It's not necessarily the case that that was the better candidate, but at least it's going to be the candidate that more people supported. That's what we know, is that there was more, and that they're sort of representing. And, you know, in the case of a war, I mean, like, suppose that, you know, Russia had just crushed Ukraine within the first 2 months, as many people all around the world thought that it would. And all those people thought it shouldn't, but they thought it would. Would we want to say, well, then what Russia did was right? I guess they were correct then. I certainly don't think Ukrainians would say that. I think even if they lost, they wouldn't think. And this is the odd thing. This is the sort of inconsistency, is that they think that they're fighting for the glory of Ukraine, in the sense that they think that if they win, that will establish the glory of Ukraine. But if they lose, they're not going to concede like, oh, actually, Russia was right. And wait, sorry, before you interrupt. And I think that Russia's probably thinking about this the same way, and that this could actually be like kind of a clue as to why wars drag on so long in certain parts of the world, which is that if people are really, really fixed on the thought that this war is fighting in the sense that I'm articulating, and that we are arguing by means of weapons, it's almost like, well, no matter what the other side does to you, it still feels to you like I still think I'm right. And so I need to prolong this. And maybe at times in history where people are actually less attached to that interpretation of war, the wars could end more quickly. You'd also predict that in our situation, we would end up inside of fewer wars.
So real argument, as you and I well know, it is pretty far from the ideal of a process such that the truth always out. People have different levels of charisma and cleverness and, rhetorical skills, and can recruit allies in various ways. So when we have arguments, even our best arguments, and the arguments that most persuade audiences, there is a lot of this element of conflict and fighting where people just push for their side to win with a wide range of tools, some of which are dirtier than others from the point of view of the truth. So we can all acknowledge that in principle, when our best institutions produce an answer, it could be wrong because of these factors, but in some sense, we tend to accept it as the best we've got if those are the best institutions we have. So then the question is, well, really, what interesting can we say other than every time an institution of ours gives an answer, it could have been wrong, and we all know it could have been wrong, but hey, we got to go on. What else is there? I mean, obviously, we could think about designing better institutions and trying to mitigate, you know, reduce the influence of those factors, but seems to me merely pointing out, hey, it still could be wrong. We made this choice. It was our best guess, but it still could be wrong is true. But what follows from it?
So I think there's a couple of different things that follow here. So first of all, like once you start to see that a lot of what we're doing involves pretend arguing.
Well, you say pretend arguing, but I'm talking about our best arguments. Even in our best arguments, you're calling that pretend arguing as if.
Yeah.
Then there never is a real argument, right? There's in practice, we only ever have pretend arguments.
Right, but we can have degrees of it, is my point. And I think that first to see that a lot of what we think of as fights, like political fights, the things that we think of most as fights are going to be the ones where the element of pretense is going to be able to be most clear and visible to us. And that the glory that we seek there is the product of an illusion that we're foisting upon ourselves about how we see it. That to me is very useful because it suggests that at a personal level, you can try to opt out of that. That is, you can, that kind of imagining yourself as winning isn't doing anything. It isn't helping anyone. It isn't helping you. And so you could actually just try to adhere to norms that where you try the as best you can to just be arguing whenever you're arguing. And if you're not arguing, not to pretend that you're arguing. And I think
take two people in a company or five trying to convince the boss to go their way in a policy dispute. Like, we can invest in this or invest in that or make a choice, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we all know that making these arguments, the boss is going to make a decision, but we have all these moves we could make that are not entirely truth oriented. That is, they allow our prestige and our charisma and recruitment of resources to help us influence this particular persuasion of effort for the boss. But we know, we accept this norm usually that, well, once the boss makes this decision, we're all behind it, even though we had reservations before. We know maybe that in principle there could have been some institution that might have eliminated these other influences, but we're not in that, or we don't know exactly how to move to it. And so, I mean, I don't know why we would call ourselves in a pretend argument here. It's a real argument with the real usual constraints, with the real usual consequences. And it is correlated with the truth in the sense that, you know, we did mention actual facts and have actual arguments that are actually relevant. And so there is a tendency of this process to go in the right direction, but there's also a bunch of other things going on. Why not just call it that way? What would opting out here in this situation mean exactly? Aren't you going to want to persuade the boss as best you can with the tools you have? Well, is the idea to say you should, you know, reject all the imperfect tools you might use in this dispute and only give pure arguments that couldn't be polluted by other factors? Is that the picture?
I guess I do think that it is, you shouldn't imagine that you're arguing when you're doing something else.
But we're doing both, right?
Right.
We're always doing both. So what's this point?
So I think that, so you keep saying this thing where it's like, well, we have to accept it at the end, or there's a norm that you have to accept it, and we're all behind it. And I think that that, I mean, maybe that is the norm that I'm sort of calling into question a little bit. Like, look, there's one thing, which is like, don't start any new fights, because that's going to like be inefficient if our processes sort of have to keep, you know, resolving the same old disagreements, right? But I think that there's a way that people conduct their everyday lives that involves like sort of like thinking that you're right about everything and being very insistent that you're right about things, and then being very offended if anyone ever gives you a counter argument, and where we can then say, no, that's not the best way to be. It's better to be what we might call open-minded. And then you might think, yeah, the same thing is true of institutions. It may even be true of institutions like the criminal justice system, even when they're like putting someone to death. And that like the set of norms, I hadn't thought about it this way before, but like the set of norms we have is to say like, look, we know for sure we're doing the right thing in putting this person to death. We somehow, it's like we weigh all the evidence and we do all this complicated stuff. But then at the end, what comes out has to be certainty rather than the truth, which is something like we have better reason to believe that they're guilty than anything else. And it's pretty good reason and it's up to a certain standard, but they might be innocent. And so, yeah, it may be that at an institutional level, we should become more friendly to the idea that all we've done is establish that this is the most likely result, not that it's like the correct one. And we don't all have to walk out saying this is the correct result, but that, you know, relitigating the case has certain costs and you shouldn't do it unless, you know, okay, the relevant circumstances obtain.
But this sounds just like you're saying don't be overconfident. But I mean, sometimes people are overconfident. Most of these disputes, I think the boss is willing to say, I'm 70% sure this is the right direction or something, but I made the choice and we're going to go with it. It's a common rationalist, you know, complaint that people talk as if they were confident and they should give degrees of belief and then explicitly say some degree of uncertainty. But that seems to be somewhat performative and not actually very helpful unless something matters. That uncertainty matters somehow. Otherwise, you're
right. I agree. And so I haven't specified yet how that would be manifested. But like something that we've talked about is that institutions are not very open to experimental innovation that might fail about how they might, say, improve their methods, especially really entrenched institutions like universities. I think degrees of belief doesn't give you much of anything, but I think actual openness to those forms of innovation, and like, for instance, if we were open to forms of collecting and adding up evidence in a trial that are different from the ones that we've used until now, that would be a way of acknowledging that our results are not as good as they could be.
Well, let's talk about the usual issues with respect to overconfidence. The first usual complaint is, hey, your evidence can't support the confidence high levels, therefore you should be more rational. But the counter argument is often to say, look, there are often important signaling games where you're trying to show confidence. So many people disapprove and dislike people who are less confident. Men are often told they need to be more confident in their date, they're approaching women and in their interactions with women. And women are looking at their confidence. If they don't seem confident enough, if they seem honestly uncertain, they're going to be rejected and they should just be more confident. And people love a confident person and the world likes confidence. So we wanted to ask, well, you know, what's the process there by which confidence is desired and rewarded and is it legitimate? That is, will we in the end say, okay, confidence is good for good reasons? I mean, you know, you're a woman, ask yourself, imagine the unconfident man. How do you feel about him? Do you feel respecting his epistemic honesty, or do you feel he's a little weak?
So I think that the association between confidence and certainty is makes sense, but it's not necessary. That is, we sort of have this thought that the person who is the person who doesn't take themselves to know has given up. And so they appear as though they lack energy. And I think you can be very energetically inquisitive And in that sense, maybe confidence isn't the right word, but there's some kind of positive attribute that you would have that would play the role of confidence. It's just that I think people are not good at seeing the space between I'm completely certain and I know, like somebody who's just very enthusiastic about you, right? Like a man who's very enthusiastic, who's very eager to get to know you. They don't have to be confident that you're going to want them. They don't have to be like certain that you'll say yes. But in fact, that kind of certainty might be off-putting. But what you want, you don't want some weak, shy, retiring man who's like obsessed about whether he's going to experience rejection or not and barely even paying attention to you, right? You want someone who has like the energy and the boldness and the courage to be like, yeah, maybe she's going to reject me and maybe that will suck, but I don't care. I'm willing to move forward.
So in a typical situation where the boss says, okay, we're going with plan A, it'll be great. Let's do it. And everybody says, okay, good, we're behind it. I mean, you could say he's rejecting that sort of energy. You might call him overconfident, but I'm actually doubting whether he actually says the things you think might make him overconfident. I think typically people tend to attribute to them high levels of confidence when they don't actually say it directly.
Right. So that's fair. And so like if the boss is just being energetic rather than overconfident, that's fine. As we were saying earlier, I don't think the issue is about degrees of credence. I think the issue is about how is the boss going to relate to somebody saying, well, you know, the option that we just rejected at pretty low cost, I could pursue it on the side. Should I do it or not? And like the boss I'm imagining, the one who is energetic, would say, yeah, great. They would be even more energetic because now the chances that we're going to go right have increased, right? But the boss who was resting their energy on a false certitude would feel threatened by that and would say, no, don't do that. So that will be the mark of the difference.
So I'm just wanting more evidence that there's actually this problem. I mean, if we say there's this problem in the world of people being overconfident in their institutional choices, I'm not sure I actually see it. I see people looking for a decisive answer and then for people to move on and to accept it. I'm not actually sure I see high levels of confidence in those choices.
So first of all, I would say if you want to see the problem that I'm pointing out, the first place to look is not institutional judgments, because those are working pretty well, not perfectly, but pretty well as far as what I'm talking about. Look at wars. I mean, literal wars like Russia and Ukraine, or look at politics, which is warlike. So those are going to be the primary cases where you see this pretense. Now, if we want to go and look at like how businesses are run, how academia runs, how the judicial system runs, the place where you would see the problem is, insofar as there is one, the resistance to procedural innovation.
So, I mean, in politics, there's all these standard incentives for confidence, which have to do mostly with showing your allies that you're loyal to them. Once my side has decided abortion is bad and needs to be squashed, then my side is wary of hearing my, uncertainty and qualifiers about that. That is right. Often with respect to loyalty, people who are trying to hedge are suspected. We want to see just a full loyal joining of our side.
Yeah.
Is that wrong?
Yeah, wrong. Because all of that is predicated on the framework that you guys are in a battle against the other side, a battle where glory is at stake, and you'll get glory if your side prevails. And you don't even care that much about whether there's abortion or not. There's lots of ways where all the underlying factors can be manipulated and you don't care about. You care about the ones that symbolize your victory. And yeah, all of that is just you being caught in a pretense. That's bad.
So there's this analogous thing in trials where, you know, each lawyer and each side says, The truth will be found by this process whereby yeah. Each of us push our side as best we can. So I'm going to push my side as best I can and trust the other side will do that. And isn't that analogous to the political faction pushing their side of the political battle? That is, they have a, you know.
I don't think so. It could be, depending on the lawyer's tactics, right? So if like one of my tactics as a lawyer is to flood you with so much decoy evidence and discovery that you can't like find the truth, then that would be very similar to the political strategies. But if the weapons, so to speak, that you're using are considerations that bear on the truth of the claim you're trying to establish, then I think we're not in a pretend argument. We're in a real argument. It's a bit of a weird argument because it's happening with this like kind of disembodied way where there's this third party that's listening to it. And there are odd things about that, and it's imperfect in various ways, but it's a lot closer to the real thing than, you know, the case where, like, in the abortion case, the way you can sort of see that that's pretense is that if what you really wanted to do is establish that your side was right, you'd be quite attentive to the hedging uncertain person who might give you some good reasons to think you're wrong. So if you're shutting that person down, that can't be a real argument. That tells
you. Okay, so if in trials we think there are legitimate and illegitimate moves with respect to the trial process giving a truthful outcome,
yeah,
then what we usually want is the trial, you know, overseer, the judge, to rule on legitimate and illegitimate moves. So, for example, we have rules of evidence and other rules about what are legitimate rules. And then we might think that if it's allowed by the game, then we as a lawyer need to make the moves that will help us win that are allowed by the game, because otherwise people won't hire us anymore. So now you might be saying, you're asking me to sacrifice my career success for this extra truth that will come by me not using a move that I could use in this game. But, you know, if the world is trusting this process, not my extra devotion to truth, then shouldn't I just give the usual level of devotion to truth that's implied by how this game is set up? And we should change the game if we want people to make better moves instead of asking for people to make personal sacrifices.
Yeah, that's fair. So like, I guess all of it seems fair except for the personal sacrifice part. That is, it seems like you're making the personal sacrifice by playing the game.
Well, you're paid to be a lawyer here, so.
Right. So like one way you can see what you're doing, it depends on how you see what you're doing. But so I think that like right now you and I are arguing, right? And we don't have rules that we don't have like rules of evidence that like you tried to make a rule before we started talking about how we had to agree on the definition. And I was like, no, I don't agree to the rule. And yet we're still talking. Right. So we don't have a set of rules that were that determine what are the legitimate and the illegitimate moves. If you think one of my moves is illegitimate, you just got to sell me on that by like explaining to me why it's illegitimate. And all you have is my agreement. And that to me is the ideal case. I think what we think in the context of a trial is we think that the illusion of battle is kind of a useful one. It's kind of one that we can deploy usefully in certain contexts and maybe even safely if we independently constrain the moves of the battle to, this battle produces the truth. And that's how we're imagining it goes in the courtroom. And so then there's something odd about lawyers. It's almost like they're not people. They're just cogs in this truth machine. And maybe that's a way that they can think about themselves. I'm a cog in a truth machine. Here are the moves that are available to me. I'm going to make all the moves. And you know, in that way, that once again, glory wouldn't come into play. Like it would just be, they're just doing their job. And maybe that's right. I think, you know, from all of my knowledge of lawyers, which all comes from TV shows, lawyers do very much get caught up in both the pursuit of the truth and the pursuit of glory. So, and don't see themselves as cogs in a machine.
I think academics often play this cogs in the machine game. That is, academics themselves often say, it's the job of the overall academic system to sort out the truth. My job is to get as many publications in the top journals as I can, and then I will use as many moves as I can find that will be accepted by the journals and by the larger system, because my job is just to succeed. And I think that people in conversations like you and I might well want to have a judge if it were feasible, and maybe some AI system in the future will make that more feasible. We might well want to have some rules imposed on us by an independent third party about what conversation moves we can make. So it's not clear that what we're doing now is the ideal relative to a court. It might be the court is an ideal relative to what we're doing now. And so again, there's this most fundamental question, you have this ideal of truth and you think of all these moves you can make in these various conversations. And the question is, to what extent do we, in, you know, hold people to the standard of only making the moves that will produce, make the whole system move toward the truth maximally, ignoring all of the personal considerations, including their career and their safety and everything else? Or will you allow people to sort of hold the game responsible for the truth and let individuals in the game make whatever moves help them win their game? That's a fundamental question here. Who we hold responsible for what with respect to our systems of conversation and producing truth.
Right. So, like, it could well just be that you and I differ on this, right? And you're okay being a cog in a machine and I'm not. And so, from your point of view, there are these more ideal cases where we have the judges set over us. And I'm like, no, that wouldn't be better. But I want to go back to the case of academia, right? So you say a lot of people see themselves as like cogs in a machine and the referee system, you know, is supposed to sort out the truth. But like, yeah, people say that sometimes, but I like, it's really, really rare for someone to say, my paper was rejected by a journal, therefore it's bad. Pretty much like all the time, they think, oh, that's because the referees were bad or the system is corrupt. People feel like pretty, they take the liberty to be like, no, I know my paper is right and good. And so that seems to me to indicate people's sort of unwillingness actually to hand over this authority over truth seeking to some higher body. And that's what I was saying about the lawyers. The lawyers are also unwilling. If you are willing to do that, it might be perfectly fine. I'm not objecting to that. I'm not saying the system in which we do that is bad. I'm saying the system in which we don't do that and then fight sort of like proxy wars over the truth by means of things that are not relevant to the truth, that is bad.
So I've seen this issue come up in many other contexts in economics. There's something that goes wrong in the world. And one solution is to preach to people to be more considerate of the world by doing the things that will make the world better. Like, don't pollute as much. Don't drop as many, pick things off the street and put it in the trash can, or be polite to your neighbor, et cetera. And then we economists are often asking, well, how can we change the systems so that we won't have to preach to people, so that it'll be more directly in their interest to get the better outcomes? And I think in the long run, that's just much more promising. Obviously, sure, make all the preaching you can, but just generically, people have a limited willingness to, you know, promote the truth or promote society or whatever else it is your preaching is encouraging them to do. It's much more productive, I think, to say, how could we change the rules of conversation, rules of courts, etc., in order to get to align the fighting with the truth, the conflict with the truth, such that according to the acceptable rules of this sort of a conflict, in fact, when people fight according to those rules, then the outcome is more aligned with the truth. That's, to me, much more promising. I'm not telling you not to preach. I'm just saying it's, you know, been tried. It's old. It doesn't, you know, repeating that we should preach more doesn't get us that far.
I don't think I am preaching. I think you're misunderstanding me. I think what I'm saying is there's something you could do in your own self-interest. There's something you could be doing in your own self-interest. Do you need to stop?
No.
Okay.
All right. In a minute or two, I do.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Which is to say, you're living a lie, and you know, if once someone comes to see that, they very naturally come to want to not live the lie. And so it's not a matter of me preaching to them. It's that like everyone can just be better off by their own life. And I'm just explaining how that can be the case.
I mean, in an academic game, I could make a paper that was more truth-oriented, have it rejected, and then not get tenure and leave. And so the question is, I'm faced with a difficult choice. I don't think I'm living a lie if I structure the papers, et cetera, to be what the academic world wants for
sure.
Temporary time while I need to.
Right. So you might say, look, I'm going to get out of the truth game and I'm just going to try to get tenure. That's fine. I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. I also wasn't saying you shouldn't be a cog in the machine. What I was saying is if you do get the paper accepted, don't see it as a victory or a triumph. You haven't achieved anything grand or anything noble or anything worth being proud about. You've just tried to take a step to prevent yourself from starving, which is
I disagree strongly here. That is, if you think that on average this process does produce truth, then on average your participation, if it gets accepted, is a validation to some degree of its truth, even if you didn't do everything exactly such that you only did moves that would maximally promote truth. Still, if the system on average produces truth and your thing accepted by the system, then you do get to believe that you are partially validated.
Sure, but to the extent that you believe you're partially validated, then you also have to believe when your paper gets rejected, oh, I guess it wasn't that.
Yes.
Kind of a paper. Right. So my point is, like, there would be a marker of somebody who had the psychology that you're describing, and that's not actually the way that academics are. They would see it, and it's just like the war with the if the Ukrainians triumphed over the Russians, they would see that as a triumph for the principle of Ukraine, and they don't see the opposite as, I guess Ukraine wasn't really worth defending. So
I think most lawyers do see losing a case as a criticism of them that they take to heart.
Right. So I think lawyers might actually be the closest thing to the cogs in the machine case. And yeah, I think if you're a cog in the machine.
Most academics do, in fact, take repeated rejection of their paper as news about its value.
I think that they just as frequently take it as news about, like, the way the system is rigged against them, at least in my experience. We should stop.
All right. Nice talking. Bye.
Bye.